Good morning. I'm Mark Allen with Gaper.io, and I'm here today with Brandon McKenzie, the CEO of Listacross. Good afternoon in your case, Brandon. How you doing?
Oh, 10 out of 10. How are you?
10 out of 10. Well, I'm about a 9.5 out of 10, so I got a little bit more to come up. But it's still
All
early
right,
in the morning.
Let's get there.
Yeah, it's,
yeah.
I've got another 3 hours to catch up to you, so we're good.
Great.
So to start with, can you just share a brief back history of your background and what you did before Listacross?
Oh yeah, I've done all sorts of things. I'm a professional dilettante. I had a former career in entertainment, and then I was an attorney, trying to still be a recovering attorney, but you know, that never really dies in you. I founded a short-term rental management company. You know, these things are ubiquitous now, but sort of when Airbnb was in its infancy, you know, we had about 300 plus properties under management, sold out of that company in 2018, ran a tech company in the same space for a while, went back to practicing law, and then back at Listacross. So it's been a long and winding road.
Wow. Sounds like you've done a little bit of everything.
You betcha.
Yes. So, all right. Well, now that we're talking about Listacross, what does Listacross do and who is your target audience?
Yeah. So Listacross is great. We empower mostly small and medium sized businesses to reach millions of new customers that they're not reaching today. So we do that by allowing them to take their inventory and cross post it across multiple peer-to-peer marketplaces. So think Facebook, Etsy, eBay, and it's also a two-way street. So if they have a pre-existing Shopify store, we let them import their inventory from their Shopify store and then distribute it to all these channels and manage it all from one place without the need for multiple logins.
Very good. So it sounds like you empower, you know, sales channels and marketing people to one-stop shopping for whatever sites they want to be on, correct?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's what we're striving for.
Cool. So a big time, and I know people using Shopify, it could be a very big time saver because I know that they hire people just to do those other things, correct?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I'd say, you know, when we ran our pilot before we built the current iteration of the product, we were working with a number of small and medium-sized retailers. And we'd speak to them consistently and say, you know, what's your solution now? And they'd say, we're doing this or we want to be doing it, but it's untenable if you do it manually. You know, they're posting on platforms like eBay and Poshmark, you know, high-end jewelry and clothing and things like that. And sometimes at the point of sale in the store itself. So let's say, you know, you have a $2,000 purse that sells in the store and you forget to take it down off of eBay and Poshmark and it sells there again.
Ooh.
You know, now you've got a piece of unique inventory that you can no longer sell. You know, you're basically juggling it all the time. So you have to make sure you're staying on top of this, logging into every single platform, remembering where you logged or remembering where you posted things so you can take them down, edit them, update them, this, that, the other. And we just take all the pain out of that for the sellers by letting them do it all from our platform. And all that data synchronizes in basically real time.
Wow, that is quite powerful. I mean, I do know what's involved in doing everything you just said, and it's a lot of coordination. So sounds like a great product. So interesting. And you started this company back in 2020, correct?
Yeah, I did. So my co-founder and I were in an accelerator, and he's a growth marketer with about over a decade of e-commerce experience. He's sold 3 consumer packaged goods brands. Really brilliant guy. And I'd been noodling around on this idea for quite some time. So that tech company I mentioned that I used to run, we did the same thing, but for vacation rentals. So it's, you take 300 Airbnb listings and we cross post them on booking.com, Vrbo, Expedia, things like that. You manage your communications, your calendar, all from one place. And sort of my, you know, hero or villain origin story, however you look at it, was, I used to be a Craigslist arbitrage junkie back in the day, and it's sort of a terrible habit that never really died in me. When I was 21, 22, I just come out of college. I had no money. I moved to California, but I did have a truck. And that was great because I would take my laptop to the public library and I'd go on the free section on Craigslist. And typically, you know, there'd be stuff coming out of fancy offices in Beverly Hills or West Hollywood. And these folks would say, uh-oh, we didn't plan properly. We have this, you know, $7,000 white leather Gucci couch that needs to be out of here today. You know, whoever can get here first gets to take it. And so I'd be like, all right, I'm available. And I'd drive over there. I'd load it into my truck. And then I'd park. And I'd wait 24, 48 hours for them to take the ad down. And I'd post it back up for sale and offer delivery. And, you know, I was an enterprising young lad. And, you know, I guess I've kind of been doing that ever since. And it's, a, you know, when, you know, practicing law, if you think about the billable hour, it's an absolutely terrible use of time. So, but I really do still derive a lot of enjoyment from it. So, you know, there'll be, you know, I'm here in New York. So every once in a while, you'll have, you know, some, I hate to use this term pejoratively, but some finance bro who will go skiing with his buddies for the first time. And he'll go to the mountain. They'll say, what are the most expensive skis you've got? And they'll spend $2,000, $2,500 on skis, ride them not realizing that they're for an expert, crash, realize, hey, maybe this isn't for me. And they sit in a closet. And then come July, when people are doing spring cleaning, they end up on Craigslist or OfferUp or Facebook Marketplace. And, you know, I'll love all, say, hey, look, I'll give you $100 for them and take them out. There's no market for skis in July. Hang on to them. Go ride them all winter, and then in February, sort of tail end of the season, sell them for $1,000, $1,100, $1,200. And like I said, you know, if I think about my billable hour, not a great use of my time, you know, schlepping down to the financial district, looking, making sure they're not damaged, coming back, you know, riding, posting them at the end of the season on Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace, OfferUp, any number of other places. But I still enjoy it. I don't know. I can't shake the habit. And so, with all that in mind, I had that, you know, terrible hobby. And I thought, is there a way to merge these two worlds, my worst hobby and my knowledge of sort of this tech ecosystem of, you know, multi-channel distribution? And so when I met my co-founder, he and I started validating the idea and doing customer outreach and paying people and saying, you know, is this something you do? Is it something you do manually? Does it hurt, you know, to do it? Do you do it anyway, even though it hurts? You know, and with that in mind, if there were a solution for the problem that you think you already have, you know, what would you be willing to pay for it? And we dabbled around with that idea for months, you know, for a couple of months doing user research, and we sized out the market and we're like, look, this is a multi-billion dollar opportunity. That's great. And so then we hacked together our terrible little first iteration of our product, and we can get into that more if you're interested. And there was real demand. We had almost 400 retailers sign up. We, you know, just created a landing page and we're pinging these people. And the thing was breaking left, right, and center. You know, the product wasn't great, but it was validating. And now, you know, we're on to sort of a much more robust version of the product. And then in 2020, as you mentioned, you know, right after we sort of hacked together this V1 of our MVP, pandemic hits. And it was sort of a watershed moment for us, like light bulbs going off over our heads, because we saw what was happening to brick and mortar retailers. These small mom and pop shops are just getting eviscerated because some of them have no e-commerce presence at all. Or if they do, it's minimal. You know, maybe they have a Shopify store, but, you know, or they're paying, you know, for Google AdWords. They're relying on a lot of native foot traffic, word of mouth, people finding them on Google, but they're not household names. These are hyper local or very localized businesses. And yeah, maybe they have a Shopify page. Maybe they can, you know, they have a little bit of an e-commerce presence, but that still requires people to find their websites first or walk in their stores. So we got to thinking, well, we're taking all this inventory and we're putting it on peer-to-peer marketplaces. And there are millions of eyeballs, millions of people looking at those things every day anyway, you know, can't we extend the reach of these small and medium-sized retailers exponentially by giving them access to our platform? And so that's kind of the bent our product has taken. That was our first little, you know, micro pivot. Now we still get inbounds constantly of people, say in New York, being like, I would kill for this. You know, I'm moving from one New York City apartment to another. I want to sell all my stuff. Can I have your platform? You know, that would be amazing. And look, there's room in our platform for those people. But I think our primary focus is on these small and medium-sized retailers, because rather than them doing audience building and targeting ads on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and Google and things like that. Let's say, I don't know, you have an iPhone for sale. You know, you're a small electronics retailer in New York. Rather than, you know, putting up ads on Google, we're basically saying, take that inventory, and you're flashing a billboard now in front of millions of eyeballs that you didn't have yesterday, exactly where they're looking for that thing. So it's, you know, consumer electronics, subcategory cell phone, subcategory iPhones, subcategory iPhone 12 Pro, and then there's your item. And how many thousands of people in your local market or beyond, if you're willing to tip, are looking for exactly that thing? Like, you know, this is a precision targeted billboard for those eyeballs.
Very cool. Wow. That's and that's in basically you've done this in about 2 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, not even. So once we did that retailer pilot, you know, the product was, it kind of worked, but things were breaking left, right, and center. And we were giving it to these retailers and we had too many signups. And we went back and we figured, maybe we can slow things down. Let's tell them, you know, after the first 30 days, hey, thanks for playing, you know, trial runs over. And now we're going to start charging for it. And we thought, all right, well, that will stem the flow. Maybe people will say, hey, I'm not ready to pay for this thing that kind of half works. But that wasn't our experience. They came back to us. They're like, cool, where do we send the money? How much, you know, can we keep going? Because there were retailers that, you know, there's one I'm thinking of in particular. We ended up making them, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 in found revenue, traceable directly through our platform. But in addition to that, they made a bunch of ancillary revenue that we couldn't even effectively track. So for example, this is back before OfferUp acquired LetGo, we published their inventory on LetGo, and, you know, people would say, hey, is it still available? Da, da, da. Yep. Sure. No problem. Come into our store. Here's our hours. And folks would show up at their store and say, hey, look, I don't want that couch anymore, but I'm going to take three or four other things. You know, because now they've got this extra foot traffic, and we didn't have a good way to effectively trace or track that revenue. I mean, we tried coupon codes and things like that. You know, you're relying on the person to remember to say, hey, you know, if I use the code list across a point of sale, do I get my 5% off? And then having the retailer report it back to us. It was all very rudimentary at the time, but all these people came to us. They're like, no, we're making all this extra money. It's working. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll happily pay for it. And that was a little bit of a surprise for us. So we said, look, we're really flattered, but we're going to pull the plug because the wheels are coming off the machine a little bit at the moment. But we'll circle back with you when we're good and ready. And then we had all this data that was really validating where people are, you know, we're solving the pain point that they actually have, and we're making them a bunch of extra money. And so we shopped that around to investors for probably the next 30, 60 days. We raised our pre-seed round, and then we probably spent another 2 months vetting developers. And that was a pretty exhausting process. But ultimately we got a great team and they've been building it ever since. You know, I know you mentioned you checked out our website, you know, there's that, which is sort of the consumer facing. And then there's the more robust back end, which nobody sees really what's under the hood, but, it is awfully complicated. And we're about to put the current version of the product into beta. We had a little bit of setback because our developers are fantastic. Unfortunately, you know, bless them, they're Ukrainian. And, you know, I'm not sure if you heard, but...
something going on there?
Yeah. So that's there's a little bit of a geopolitical hiccup there that set us back by, you know, close to 3 months. Yeah. But they're all safe, and they've sort of redistributed. Spain, Estonia, said the other. Now we're ready to go. So our plan is to put it into beta next week and give it away for free, largely to solicit feedback from users. And we've got about a 40,000 person wait list. And so we're going to go through those and say, hey, you know, who wants to volunteer as tribute here? And you can use it for free. Just tell us what you think, what you love, what you hate, what we got right, what we got wrong, and what we need to build next. And then, you know, we're relying on our future customers, I think, just to tell us what hurts the most and how we fix it. And then we'll build the things that they want.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. So interesting. You started a company basically during not a depression, but a pandemic, and you chose developers in another part of the world. Was that a, before COVID, you think you would have had a team in New York, or did COVID say, hey, we can get them from anywhere, so let's go just find the best people available?
Yeah, so we did talk to a few folks in New York, but ultimately, you know, offshoring and going to Ukraine, we found that the tech talent was phenomenal. Like, these guys are absolutely fantastic. And it's just far more cost effective. Mm-hmm. Like, the value for money, the hourly rates, or, you know, sort of the flat rate structures, if you're dealing with folks in Ukraine versus the US, I mean, it's apples to oranges here. There's no comparison. It's a fraction of the cost for the same, if not better, quality coding.
Yes. And well, since that's what Gapers does, I will have to agree with you on that. And I have dealt with some of the developers from, you know, Eastern Europe, and they are quite good. And you don't have to pay for an Ivy League graduate, you know, and pay, you know, well over 100K to get good talent. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, and maybe we could talk about this. What are the biggest challenges then? I mean, the obvious one is the time difference.
Yeah. So asynchronous communication is definitely tricky. Our guys are good, especially now that they're in Spain and Estonia. It's not so bad. But I think post-launch, once we have a bunch of users, if we need to manage things on the fly, one of the things that we're concerned with and one of the things that we're trying to build and structure around at the moment is, let's say something, you know, mission critical kind of breaks and they're sound asleep and it's 3 a.m. What does that scenario look like? How do we pinch hit? You know, asynchronous communications when you're in sort of non-urgent sprints, like, you know, everything has some sense of urgency, but there are fires and there are like fires. Mm-hmm. you know, that hasn't been terrible. Like, there's a lot of back and forth. We all live on Slack. We eat, sleep, and breathe it. And we had a product manager, you know, on that team who was pretty good at working our hours. You know, he could crisis manage a bit. I'd say that's probably the biggest challenge. The other thing is when we're dealing with integrating with, you know, huge, 800-pound gorilla behemoth platforms like Facebook, for example. You know, we're dealing with Facebook Marketplace, and yes, they can use VPNs. They can use, you know, all sorts of tools to mask their location and identity, you know, while we're testing new tools that don't exist. Like, some of this stuff, you know, we don't have public API access. So we're hacking around things. And we're like, I'm going to try a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. Fine. And they need to make it appear as though they're in the US, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with 90% of websites, no problem. They're like, yep, your address registers as being in New York or Atlanta or Chicago or wherever you want to be. But when you're dealing with a behemoth like Facebook, you can have, you know, 20 layers of tools that are supposed to mask your identity and show where you are, and they'll figure it out. And we ended up getting all these security flags being like, hey, look, we see a suspicious login from a weird part of Ukraine. Was this you? And if we're trying to run, you know, 200 processes, and I have to open 200 tabs and click, yes, it was me, yes, it was me, yes, it was me, over and over again. I can't tell you, God, there was a night where I was probably doing, I did that at like 11:30 at night, and I just sat there clicking, yes, it was me, over and over again, and entering the little CAPTCHA thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fun though. They're good learnings. You figure out ways around those things. So there are tools to resolve those CAPTCHAs, you know, in somewhat of an automated fashion. So everything's a learning experience.
Yes. And yeah, and it's interesting. Sounds like an idea for another business, doesn't it?
Yeah. So believe it or not, there are companies that do that. There, it's funny. One of the first things we did is there are click farms where it's actual human beings overseas, and they just do this in volume. It's like the little picture, the pop up of, like, you know, click on the traffic light, things like that. Show up in front of somebody's screen, and they actually click through it for you to run the process.
Wow.
I didn't even know that existed before Lissacross, you know?
Yeah, me neither. Wow. So, and it's interesting, the thing you talk about is the disparate time differences, right? You know, in IT, I've been in IT for many years, and the way we did that always, and you can do that with someone in another country, is, you know, 1 week of the month, your job, your night support, right? And
yeah.
If your phone rings, you answer it. And if not, you get a good night's sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, we had that. So my the company I mentioned before, the short-term and vacation rental management company, we outsourced our dev. We built a tech product. This is back in like 2014 or 15. And our developers were in India. And that was unusually an 11 and a half hour time difference. Yes.
Or 12, depending.
Yeah, it was bizarre. I'm like, all right. Before that, I didn't even know there were half hour time zones. Mm-hmm. But there we are. But we had a large-ish team, and they worked in two shifts. So we kind of had somebody staffed at any given time of the night, day or night when we first launched. After a while, we were able to sort of taper that off. But it was sort of the crisis manager real time for exactly that reason.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you've figured it out. But I mean, for those people that are thinking about using remote developers, there are some challenges, but I think once you get going, it works out really well. And the other thing is, I think it forces the company to design products better, because you're sending something 10,000 miles away, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. And you know that they're working when you're not. So you really do have to design things better. Would you agree with that?
I would. Yeah. And that's, you know, I do find that our current team is exponentially better than that prior team from mm-hmm. that other company. Because we're really, really judicious in our vetting process. It's mm-hmm. It can't be understated how important that is. You know, we got a lot of personal referrals from folks who'd worked with certain teams before. I went sort of through my network. My co-founder went through his network. You know, it was pretty intense vetting process. But I think that level of work early on at the outset really pays dividends, because with our first team, we had to handle everything. It was like, if we didn't write specs out to a T, they had no intuition. There was no, you know, I'll give you just an off the shelf example. You know, when you click a drop down to select a state, for example, yes. when you're filling in an address field, mm-hmm. if I hit N, it'll jump down to the states that start with N, and then I can sort of click through it. You know, if I want to get to New York, I'll type NEW, and then, you know, maybe it'll give me New Jersey, and then I hit the down key or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's something that with our old developers at that last company, I would actually have to write out those specs in granular detail. Whereas our new guys, you know, they put together the address field. They're like, all right, that's intuitive. Let's just, you know, it's part and parcel of the process. We're building it anyway. Just add that feature without a second thought. Like, and I think that's, as silly as that sounds, that's a big difference between, you know, high quality and sort of lower quality developers. Like, these guys just get it. You don't have to shepherd them or handhold them through or micromanage every little thing, you know, and mm-hmm. you don't have to spec out, you know, everything exhaustively. So, and the reason I say, like, it sounds silly is that's sort of an off the shelf example, but you know, multiply that by 1500 features and think about how much work is involved in that. It's exhausting. You know, it's just a bad use of time and resources to be right. digging in that level of granular detail.
Yes. And I have dealt with that with development teams abroad, and you're right. Cause they don't understand, you know, the US geography at all. And there are yeah. a number of other things, and they will code exactly what you ask them to code.
Right. Yeah.
So, but, yeah. and there's pros and cons of that. So.
Yeah.
Well, Brandon, I know we've been talking for a while. It's been great talking to you. It's a great concept. I do actually have some customers I think I might be referring you to, although hopefully you can take them on.
Great.
Yeah. So I want to thank you for your time today and have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Hopefully it stays 10 of 10.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.